Welcome to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service. I'm Helen Grady. Each week, four expert witnesses answer one question from the news. This month, climate change activists have targeted cities all over the world. In London, they built a huge wooden pyramid right in the middle of the city's busiest junction. On a beach in Sydney, they buried their heads in the sand. And in Dublin, they marched as a human forest covered in twigs and leaves. All the protests were organised by Extinction Rebellion, a group that wants to stop climate change by cutting one of its biggest drivers, carbon dioxide. When it's released into the atmosphere, CO2 traps heat from the sun, causing the planet's temperature to rise. Extinction Rebellion wants governments to commit to a target of zero carbon by 2025. It's ambitious. Most people think it's impossible. The UK government has passed a law promising to reach carbon zero by 2050. But how quickly could the whole world get there? How soon can the planet reach carbon zero?
Part 1. Keeping the lights on.
"25 years ago, climate change was not the hot environmental topic. It was a niche issue. You know, people thought, oh, here's a strange academic studying a backwater topic."
Roger Pilkey Jr. started researching climate change before most of us had even heard of it. Now a professor at the University of Colorado, he's frustrated by our failure to tackle one of the biggest causes of climate change.
"Since early 1990s, the world has emitted as much carbon dioxide as it did before in all of history."
To help focus minds, scientists have developed a goal, a way of measuring our progress in cutting carbon emissions. It's called net zero.
Net zero is a concept that we should just take our emissions all the way down to zero and have none of them.
So where do we start?
The biggest source of emitted carbon dioxide from human activities is the burning of fossil fuels. It's coal, natural gas, and petroleum for transportation, for manufacturing, for construction, for households, for business. Anything that uses energy worldwide, about 85% of that energy comes from fossil fuels today.
So if I want to zone in on burning fossil fuel, where is the best place to start?
So it's conventionally understood that the lowest hanging fruit, so to speak, is in our electricity production.
About a third of fossil fuels are burned to produce electricity. If we could get rid of that, it'd be a huge step towards carbon zero. All we have to do is to wean ourselves off coal and gas-fired power stations. How hard can it be?
It's really difficult. If you do the math, you realize that, and it's mind-boggling to think of this, the world uses about 12,000 million metric tons of oil equivalent a year. That's a technical term. It's an MTOE. If you think we want to get to net zero by 2050, there's about 11,000 days to 2050. So that means to get from 12,000 to zero, we need to replace one MTOE of energy consumption every day, starting today to 2050.
So what does one MTOE of energy production look like?
One MTOE equals the equivalent of one nuclear power plant of carbon-free energy. And if you don't like nuclear power plants, 1,500 pretty good-sized wind turbines.
It's a lot of wind turbines.
We would need to deploy 1,500 wind turbines of carbon-free energy every single day, starting tomorrow, while shutting down an equivalent amount of fossil fuel generation every day until 2050.
That's 1,500 wind turbines, or one nuclear power station, every day for the next 30 years, just to keep the lights on as we turn off our old polluting power stations. And even that's optimistic, says Roger Pilkey.
It's even worse than that, because there's some 2 billion plus people who don't enjoy modern energy services like you or I do. who would like to.
So hang on, doesn't that mean that you're going to need to build more than one nuclear power plant every day until 2050?
That's exactly right. Somewhere between one and two. It's an enormous amount of energy that needs to be replaced.
Professor Pilkey says he'd be happy to live next door to a nuclear plant, but not everyone is so keen. There are only 400 nuclear power stations in the whole world, and it's hard to imagine 11,000 more being built between now and 2050. So what about the other option, more renewable energy?
I think it's been well proven in individual US states, Northern Europe and Great Britain, that we can source a sizable portion of our electricity from solar and wind. We haven't yet figured out how we get those numbers up above 50%. But it's really important for people to understand, using the technology of wind and solar, we can't build wind turbines or solar panels.
Why not? Because
it requires a massive amount of concentrated energy that we get from, say, coking coal-fired power plants. They don't give you enough bang for your buck to produce steel and concrete and so on. So we haven't figured out how to run modern society on wind and solar. And then a second issue is what happens when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow.
If you had enough investment and if you had the political will, how quickly could we achieve carbon zero?
I would say that 2050 would be incredibly ambitious, but I would think we could do it by 2100.
So we'd need an extra 50 years just to decarbonize our electricity supply. What about the other polluting sectors?
Part 2. Getting around.
Hi, my name is Rachel Moncrief. I'm the Deputy Director at the International Council on Clean Transportation, otherwise known as the ICCT.
The ICCT are the people who caught the car giant Volkswagen cheating their emissions tests. Around 11 million cars worldwide had been fitted with a device to make their CO2 emissions seem lower than they really were, which really matters because...
transport contributes about a quarter of global CO2 emissions. Transport is actually one of the most important, right behind the power sector.
So how does that break down? Rail is the least polluting, contributing just 1% of carbon emissions. Heavy goods vehicles add a third of transport emissions. Shipping is 12%, and aviation makes up 10%. Most of these can't easily be decarbonised. But the other half of emissions from cars and motorbikes can be cut, and soon.
Really, the technology is sort of there. There's a lot of stuff where it's like people are waiting for the costs to come down, or maybe there's some fine-tuning. I don't think we need any new technology breakthroughs at this point.
The answer is to switch from gas and diesel-powered vehicles to electric. And the good news is it's already happening.
Right now, there's about 5 million electric vehicles on the road globally. And the kind of nice thing is about 2 million of those were just sold in 2018. The annual sales of passenger vehicles total globally is close to 90 million. So it's still a relatively small percent of the total global sales, but it's increasing quite rapidly.
But electric cars are way more expensive than those using petrol or diesel, which means they still have a very limited market.
The three major markets that are responsible for almost all of the electric vehicle sales are the US, Europe, and China. And even within there, there are specific cities. So I would say about half of electric vehicles are sold in just 25 cities.
And even though sales of petrol and diesel cars are falling in the US and Europe,
you have really dramatic increase in car ownership in places like China. It's the biggest market in the world for new vehicle sales. It recently surpassed in the United States a few years ago. Places like India, places like Indonesia, different places in Latin America, their amount of car ownership is still going up.
Some governments are taking steps to encourage sales of electric cars, from tax breaks and free parking to banning all other cars from city centres. But even if that works, electric cars only cut carbon if they're powered by clean electricity.
And as we've heard, we might not decarbonize our energy sector until the 22nd century. For now, electric cars could be just as bad for our carbon footprint as those that run on petrol or diesel.
If they're running on electricity made with coal, you're not decarbonizing the transport sector, you're just moving the emissions upstream.
And not all forms of transport can go electric. Long-haul trucks and aviation pose big engineering problems.
There's some technologies being developed for aviation. It is possible for aviation to decarbonize. I think there's a combination of probably electric planes for maybe shorter distances. There's also renewable fuels, like really advanced biofuels and that sort of thing for aviation as well. But you're probably not going to be flying in a zero-emission plane tomorrow.
So can we remove all the carbon from our transport system by 2050?
We have not turned a corner yet for the transport sectors, but I think it's one of the only segments that's really still growing in terms of CO2 emissions.
This is bad news for the places that will suffer most if we don't stop global warming.
Part 3, Out of Africa.
My name is Professor Chukwuma Ejiokereke, and my main question is really, how do we tackle this monstrous problem of climate change in a way that does not exacerbate the problem of global poverty and inequality?
Professor Okereke is director of the Center for Climate Change and Development in his home country, Nigeria.
One of the things that breaks my heart is when I see my own father and a number of people in the village who used, for example, to make about 3 or 4 bags of rice from his land and then coming back with just a bowl full of rice grain because the land is not yielding anymore because of climate change. So I live climate change. I breathe climate change, the impact of climate change, in its multifaceted nature back home.
Many African countries are in the front line of climate change. But when it comes to cutting carbon, Professor Okereke says there's a lack of urgency among their leaders.
Until recently, one of the key iconic figures and ways through which climate change has been depicted, even in popular media, is the polar bear that is going to be swept away from its traditional homes.
Not many of those in Africa.
But not many of those in Africa. Africans are much more concerned with access to basic need, like food, like shelter, like water, like healthcare. And only recently is the argument being made forcefully that climate change is about development. So that's the number one challenge, lack of awareness.
The other challenge is money.
There are some estimates that have shown that if you were to take climate change seriously, it will increase your budget by about 500%.
Wow.
And African countries are already lacking money to pursue basic developmental needs.
And in a lot of debt as well.
And in a lot of debt. And so if you just come and slap on a climate change extra spend on their budget, many of them cannot bear it.
So that's money they don't have.
Exactly. And also, many of them are angry because they are being made to try and cough up this money when they are not historically responsible for climate change. The entirety of Africa contributes to just about 4% of global stock of greenhouse gas emission. And yet, Africa is the most vulnerable continent to climate change. And there are few that are being made to pick up the cost of climate change, which they did not cause. And they feel this is highly unfair and unjust.
And all this is happening at a time when demand for electricity and power, two of the biggest producers of CO2, is growing. Power cuts are already a problem in many African countries. And with the continent's population expected to double by 2050, African leaders need to deliver jobs, power and transport for record numbers of young people.
There's no use telling Africa, oh, you can't have development. That is hypocritical. The good news is that Africa has the willingness to embrace these new low-carbon technologies, provided most of the leaders tell me that the cost of investing or providing those technologies or are subsidized by developed countries so that they can do it in such a way that is carbon friendly.
So what does that look like? If I'm an African nation and I've got a big plan to industrialize, how do I do that without just pumping loads more CO2 into the environment?
The first thing is to help such a country, say Tanzania, to use as much renewable resources as possible.
Such as?
Oh, such as solar and wind, and in some cases it will be geothermal, and in some cases it will be gas. So Tanzania is one of the countries that have a good potential for wind and also for solar. But unfortunately, these sources of energy, although the costs are falling rapidly, the upfront cost still remains much higher than the traditional forms of energy.
So this is where you might expect somebody like the World Bank to step in and help. Are they helping?
They have put some little money here and there, but the amount of money that we are talking about is insignificant. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what is needed. Look, World Bank and IMF, they're very good at planting trees in Africa, but that's not what Africa needs. Africa needs heavy investment to power their infrastructure in a way that is climate resilient. A monorail, for example, has been done in Ethiopia, or some kind of bus rapid transit systems. Then you are helping to take billions or millions of CO2 out of the atmosphere.
If Africa is to grow economically without increasing CO2 emissions, it will need the support of richer nations and leaders who are focused. What's the soonest that Africa could go zero carbon?
Well, if these countries they are, the prospect of decarbonisation is not on table at all.
And if they get their finger out?
If they get their finger out, then we can possibly achieve decarbonisation by 2050, 2065.
It's just as likely that Africa will produce more, not less, CO2. So maybe we need to find a way to stop the CO2 getting into the atmosphere in the first place. What if we could find a way to neutralise it?
Part 4. Making the carbon disappear.
Carbon capture and storage is really critical for us to achieve net zero emissions or any sort of energy transitions. We still depend very heavily on fossil fuels, and also there are sectors that are very difficult to decarbonize, to reduce, take away their CO2 emissions. Carbon capture and storage technologies are actually allow us to do that, and allow us to do that now. And some of the things we need to realize with climate change is the urgency of the action. We need to start doing things now. We cannot wait 20 or 30 years to have the right technology.
Mercedes Maroto-Valer is director of the Research Centre for Carbon Solutions at Heriot Watt University in Scotland. She thinks carbon capture could be our best chance of achieving carbon zero. It's already being used in some power stations, which trap CO2 with pipes and funnels.
So the first thing we have to do is we have to isolate it, to separate it from the other gases, and that's what we call the capture step. Once we have captured it, and now we have a very highly concentrated CO2 stream, then we actually want to do something with that. So we want to use it, or we want to put it in a storage location, and that's the storage part. So CCS, carbon capture and storage, is really a portfolio of technologies going all the way from capturing the CO2, separating it, to transport it to a location, or using it for a specific application.
And the technology that's around at the moment, how effective is that?
So if you are looking for a power generation, as you say, coal-fired power stations, for instance, the technology can capture at least 90% of the CO2 emitted.
90%? That much?
So there is, they are very, very effective when you are looking at power plants, if you think about cement, industry, steel, all those sectors is where CCS actually is a very, very effective technology.
You might think that a technology that's so effective would be widely used, but amazingly, it isn't.
If you think all over the world, I think right now we have maybe in the order of around 40 of these large-scale plants. That's very, very small compared with the scale of what we have to do.
who's leading the way on this, and so, how far are we from capturing as much carbon as we potentially could?
So in terms of how far we are, there are other countries like Canada, there are countries like Norway as well, where they've been for quite a number of years already running large demonstration projects. The Norwegians, for instance, up in Sleipner since 1996, they've been actually storing 1 million tons of CO2 every year.
Is that a lot?
That is a lot from the point of view of the volume that is being stored and demonstrating the technology at that scale. However, that's very small if you consider the CO2 emissions worldwide that are in the order of 35 billion tons per year.
But taking carbon capture from demonstration models to the norm will be difficult. The technology is expensive and the current systems don't work in all the settings where it's needed. Also, companies won't do it unless they're forced to. But Dr. Maroto Valer is optimistic. She leads a team developing new ways of using captured carbon. At the moment, it's a pretty worthless waste product, but...
We are changing a lot of the thinking nowadays because really CO2 can be a very, very valuable feedstock, meaning that you can start a lot of other chemical processes, very valuable chemical processes that can actually be started using CO2.
She thinks this could encourage more people to invest in carbon capture.
If we keep at the speed and the things that we are seeing happening in the last months, I think we will get there. If we take our foot from the pedal, we actually may come down and we may not be able to achieve our targets.
So what's the soonest you think that we could reach carbon zero?
I think if we were to actually decarbonize by 2040, that will be already quite a big achievement.
If we're going to achieve carbon zero by 2050, we'll need to make big changes soon. That means helping developing countries to build new green infrastructure, expanding carbon capture, and phasing out fossil fuels. Can it be done? Only by investing billions of dollars. So I asked Roger Pilkey, has the money started flowing?
In most places around the world, whether it's democracies or non-democracies, the evidence suggests that the vast majority of R&D money still goes into fossil fuels.
But why would governments still be ploughing money into carbon-emitting technologies that they know that we need to wean ourselves off?
This is one of the great contradictions of climate policy. There's widespread recognition that we should be moving in a direction of reducing fossil fuel consumption. At the same time, there is the reality that 85% of the massive amount of energy we consume every year comes from fossil fuels. So you can't just unplug a power plant and turn people's lights off.
You've been listening to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Helen Grady. The programme was produced in London by Beth Sagar-Fenton and was mixed by Rod Farker.
Aerodynamics, camouflage, a sort of flexible skin, and new powerful glue,
bug-resistant materials,
scaling up the side of buildings like Spider-Man,
saving thousands of lives.
This is 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter.
I'd like you to meet what I reckon are the toughest animals on Earth.
The podcast which investigates the amazing things that animals have taught us.
I was now completely out of my comfort zone.
30 Animals That Made Us Smarter.
But now for the light bulb moment.
From the BBC World Service.
They are the stuff of science fiction.
Catch up with the whole series now.
Stay away. I don't taste good and I'm venomous.
Just search for 30 Animals That Made Us Smarter wherever you get your podcasts.